certain response roads or things like that that allow emergency services to access routes that cars and general traffic might not be able to use, or something along those lines that just allows them to get where they need to be faster.
I just feel like totally just hurt, just like thinking that it didn't have to be like this, and just wishing that there would be someone there to come to the scene as soon as possible, because a lot of times I know many people that's been in positions where they had to wait loads of minutes for ambulance to come. So yeah, just it's like not everyone has a car to get to the ambulance as well, so it's kind of hard. You might have to find different ways of transportation, and with the stress of having to deal with whoever you're dealing with at the moment, that's kind of hard to do. So yeah.
Well, it's a very unpleasant thought. I mean, I actually needed to call an ambulance just 2 days ago, and I was incredibly lucky, I suppose, because there was somebody there within 25 minutes. And that's when things are sort of quite difficult at the moment. It would be nice to think that there'll be a way to sort of supplement the service that they're providing at the moment. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, my case wasn't particularly life-threatening, but I imagine if you're lying there with a broken leg or something, I mean, that's going to be a very difficult situation for people to deal with.
It'd be awful, you know, to be in that position. But, you know, it's something that needs to be addressed along with all the other social care issues that needs to be addressed by government, yeah.
It does, because it's putting family, loved ones at risk. When you are in need, nobody is coming.
Let's look at the facts, and the statistics tell a story of concern. Since 2018, the number of paramedics has fallen from 32,200 to 28,700. Largely because of this, emergency call-out waiting times are on average 9 minutes instead of the target 7 minutes. Less serious call-out times are 46 minutes versus the 18-minute target. And non-emergency waiting times can reach as much as 7.5 hours, with one patient held in an ambulance in the west of England for 11 hours and 46 minutes.
How would people here in London feel if they had to wait for up to 7.5 hours for an ambulance to arrive?
It's happened to me so many times, I don't call ambulance again. I just get a taxi.
I'd be really like upset if I had to wait that length of time for an ambulance. Like, I have had to wait long for, like, I've called an ambulance before and had to wait 4 hours, so, but that wasn't an emergency one, so.
That's inexcusable, really. And there was another case I heard about the other day, and it was even longer than that, and the person died as a result of it. I think it was a heart problem. By the time they actually got to where they needed to get him, it was too late. So I think for a country that has the wealth of Britain, this shouldn't be happening. I think there must be a way around it. I mean, I lived in Germany for many years. I don't think in Germany this would be acceptable. It just, they would find a way to cope with whatever shortages that they had.
Be angry and, you know, yeah, and just worrying about your own health and, yeah, knowing that help is usually you associate the ambulance should be with you in 7 to 8 minutes, but are those days gone? That's, you know, yeah, yeah, be very angry, yeah.
I feel sad because I live by myself. I feel sad because you feel like no one cares about you, and you feel like the only people that would care about you, the ambulance, unfortunately, they can't be there.
It's terrible, obviously. If you have an illness or a problem, if you're sick, you need to go to the hospital, then, yeah, it's not like in the States where you'd have to pay to go for the ambulance. You know, like, I hear a lot of stories when they say if you're pregnant in the States, then you have to pay for the ambulance, so people would rather pay for an Uber. It's like, imagine having to pay for a taxi to take you to the ambulance when the ambulance should be provided there, because you pay all this tax money, and where's it going?
Really scared because, like I said, some families and some people, some individuals are home alone. They have no families, you know, so they rely on the public health service to be there for them in times of emergencies, really.
What's the public's message to government about the growing emergency in the ambulance services?
I think from a government point of view, the NHS is complex because of its size. We often talk about the inefficiencies, but it's more than that. It seems many of them are underpaid. That has to be resolved. I think they need a lot of softer support. They need their own therapies and coaching to help them with the traumas that they've been through. And as a member of the public, I've no idea.
I think supporting them as a government, listening to their complaints or comments about working conditions, hours that they work, support in terms of infrastructure that they need, and at least considering it before kind of going ahead with any sort of political agenda.
Well, I'd like them to say step up and, you know, just get with it. You know, look at what's happening out and don't sort of hide behind it. Don't be shy about it. You know, look at this, what's going on, and put some investment behind it.
Our message is to government is to basically come together and find different ways how you can promote the job for the ambulance drivers, and just basically use everything you have to try and make people want to come and work for the ambulance, and don't respect them as well.
So look at their hours, look at the work that they do, the work that's expected of them, and you know, offer them more flexible hours, more training, and more, yeah, just more help generally.
The job is very stressful and is well underpaid, so the government needs to pay people well and make sure that the working environment is safe. Also, the people need to relax about people who work in the NHS, because when they see something on social, they take it too seriously. The job is stressful, people need to de-stress, and people do things differently.
Well, I think they may find that people start becoming more active in their unhappiness with the situation. You know, I'm not sort of suggesting that people become more aggressive, but I think some kind of popular action is probably going to happen sooner or later, because people are being pressed in so many areas, and this is possibly going to be, you know, just the final straw for a lot of people.
Recruit more staffs, pay good wages, and hopefully the staff members would stay.
My message to the government is fix up. Start caring about people, because you really care about your money. That's it, you care about how your family is and everything like that, and your government, whatever. But how about the civilians? Because we make up the country, we make up the world. You know, they care about themselves until one day it's going to fall back on them. You know, that's my message to the government, is fix up.
There is no doubt the COVID-19 pandemic has contributed to the underlying issues which the ambulance service has been dealing with. Continued decline in the number of paramedics available. It is also clear that the psychological effects on those who remain continue to cause increasing concern. There have even been reports of suicide in the service.
The NHS is often described as a crowning achievement of the British state. For decades, it has served the public all year round. But with falling numbers of paramedics and almost a million calls a month, demand simply exceeds supply. As we head towards a potentially troubling winter rise in those calls, the evidence suggests that the UK emergency ambulance service is on the verge of declaring an emergency of its own.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Many of these deaths were preventable, said one Brazilian senator, adding, I am personally convinced that Bolsonaro is responsible for escalating the slaughter. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Draft Report Accuses Bolsonaro of Crimes Against Humanity for COVID-19 Recklessness. Stay tuned for more. A Brazilian congressional probe of President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic attributes more than 300,000 deaths, half of the nation's coronavirus death toll, to the far-right leader's policies. And although its initial recommendation to charge him with mass homicide and genocide has been jettisoned, the draft report still accuses him of crimes against humanity. The 1,000-plus-page document, the product of a 6-month investigation led by a special COVID-19 Senate committee, asserts that Bolsonaro intentionally let the coronavirus rip through the country and kill hundreds of thousands in a failed bid to achieve herd immunity and revive Latin America's largest economy, the New York Times reported recently. According to the New York Times, the panel initially recommended in the report that Mr. Bolsonaro be charged with mass homicide and genocide against indigenous groups in the Amazon, where the virus decimated populations for months after hospitals there ran out of oxygen. But less than a day after the Times and several Brazilian news outlets reported on those plans, several senators said that the accusations had gone too far. Recently, on the eve of the scheduled release of the report, the committee removed the recommended charges of homicide and genocide. Renan Calheiros, the centrist Brazilian senator who was the lead author of the report, said, Nevertheless, the draft report accuses Brazil's far-right leader of a total of 11 crimes, including crimes against humanity, incitement to crime, and charlatanism for his obstinate promotion of ineffective remedies such as anti-malarial drug hydroxychloroquine, The Guardian reported, adding, but perhaps the most serious allegation is that Bolsonaro's shunning of offers from vaccine manufacturers during the first year of Brazil's epidemic amounted to murder. from the report, in spite of all vaccines that were on offer, the federal government opted not to buy them. The decision that went against all the scientific studies which demonstrated their safety and effectiveness and against the advice of all of the epidemiologists who declared on a daily basis that only vaccines would save lives. The decision not to acquire vaccines between the month of July 2020 and at least January 2021, which lacked any technical or scientific basis and flew in the face of recommendations from international health authorities, ended up claiming the lives of thousands of Brazilians who would undoubtedly have made use of such vaccines. In addition to shunning vaccines and promoting false solutions, Bolsonaro, who has downplayed the seriousness of the virus since the outbreak began, dismissing it as little flu, also rejected basic public health precautions and instead discouraged mask wearing and encouraged large gatherings. Amid mounting anger from citizens over Bolsonaro's reckless disregard for the severity of the pandemic, the Senate panel held more than 50 hearings and often led the nightly news broadcast, The Times noted. They became must-see television in Brazil, featuring testimony about bribery schemes and disinformation operations. The committee is not scheduled to vote on the draft until next week, which means that it could still be revised by senators. Of the 11 members on the panel, 7 are opponents of Bolsonaro, who entered office in 2019. However, even if the commission greenlights the report, experts say that it is unlikely it would lead to criminal charges. That's because Brazil's lower chamber in Congress, which must approve the report, is dominated by right-wing supporters of the president, while the country's attorney general, a Bolsonaro appointee and ally, would be responsible for prosecuting him. Still, the draft text paints a devastating portrait of the neglect, incompetence, and anti-scientific denialism many believe has defined the Bolsonaro administration's response to a public health emergency that has killed more than 600,000 Brazilians, The Guardian noted. Brazil's COVID-19 death toll is second only to the United States, where nearly 720,000 have died from the disease, according to the latest figures from the World Health Organization. Journalist Carl Gibson argued that if the damning allegations against Bolsonaro are true, then the same can be said about former U.S. President Donald Trump, whose administration pursued the same herd immunity approach to COVID-19. The Guardian reported that many experts believe the congressional inquiry has done severe and lasting political damage to the standing of a politician who plans to seek re-election next year, but whose ratings have plunged to record lows. Calheiros, one of the longest-serving lawmakers in the 81-member Senate, told The Times that many of these deaths were preventable. I am personally convinced that he is responsible for escalating the slaughter. The Times explained the next steps. Mr. Calheiros said that if the Attorney General did not pursue charges against the President, the Senate committee would seek other potential legal avenues, including in Brazil's Supreme Court and the International Criminal Court in The Hague. If Mr. Bolsonaro is formally charged, he will be suspended from office for 180 days while the Supreme Court decides the case, said Irapua Santa, a law professor at Rio de Janeiro State University. If convicted, he would be blocked from presidency for 8 years and likely face years in prison. If Bolsonaro does manage to run for another term, polls indicate that he would lose the October 2022 race to former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a popular leftist who improved the living standards of the country's working class when he led the country from 2003 to 2010.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel seized large parts of Syria's Golan Heights during the Six-Day War of 1967. Most of the Syrian inhabitants had to flee the area. Syria tried to retake the occupied territory in 1973 in a surprise operation, but despite inflicting heavy losses on Israeli forces in that conflict, it failed to liberate Golan. The two sides signed an armistice the following year, and ever since, a United Nations observer force has been deployed on the ceasefire line. International law says Israel must withdraw its forces from the occupied Syrian territory and hand it over to Syria. But just like other parts of Israeli-occupied territories, such as the West Bank, Israel has been defying international law and has been building there. The Israeli regime unilaterally annexed Syria's Golan Heights in 1981, but the international community never recognized the move. In 2019, former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a proclamation officially recognizing the annexation, drawing condemnation from Syria and most of the world. Despite continued worldwide support for the liberation of the Heights, Israel seems to be planning to stay and expand its settlements there. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said recently that Israel will keep the territory. He also pledged to double the size of the Israeli settlers on the Golan, which is at around 20,000 in 30 settlements. The regime has now decided to push ahead with a plan to build thousands of new settler units. Since taking office in June, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has sped up expansion of settlements, and the new Golan project seems to be in line with his policy. Syria is infuriated by the regime's intensified violations in the occupied territory. Syria called on the United Nations Security Council this week to assume its responsibility and pile pressure on Israel to halt its illegal practices in the Golan Heights. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sabah, said Golan will return to the homeland sooner or later, and all the measures taken by the regime are null and void and have no legal effect. What can Syria and the international community do to push Israel to stop building on lands that international law says must be given back?
The only thing that can be done here is a policy of maximum pressure, either through armed resistance when you are in the region itself, like has been shown by the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians, and various other groups surrounding the Zionist entity itself, or if you are a nation that is further away, through continued political pressure, through support to the Palestinian cause, and through economical sanctions.
Israel has been taking advantage of American support and the decision by some Arab states to normalize ties with Tel Aviv to advance its expansionist agenda. So it will not be easy to pile political pressure on Israel at the UN or in other international bodies. But grassroots campaigns like the increasingly popular boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel have managed to hurt Israel and raise awareness about its unending violations. The movement has targeted companies that are involved in Israeli settlement construction on occupied lands. The movement also encourages international boycott of products made or partly produced in Israeli settlements.
Well, I think the boycott, divest, and sanction movement is has shown to be a quite effective and efficient method, be it, of course, one of limited means in which we specifically only talk about boycotting Israeli products, but this has already yielded some fruit. We know this because the Zionist entity has been rapidly trying to ban and illegalize the BDS movement wherever it exists.
Any new settlement in the Golan Heights could be the next target of the BDS movement.
Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisson Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probing into Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shataya called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Hassan Qasem said the move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence. Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Jabarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clearer position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now, but it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any persecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes that has given Israel the audacity to time and again attempt to defame and sabotage the work of Palestinian human rights groups to end its impunity. The regime's latest move to blacklist six Palestinian human rights groups is yet another example of Israel's systematic and relentless campaign against Palestinian civil society organizations and leading human rights defenders. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has described Tel Aviv's declaration as characteristic of totalitarian regimes with the clear purpose of shutting down these organizations. In fact, this move threatens to shut down civil society groups that document human rights violations by Israel. They report human rights abuses against Palestinian children, advocate rights of the thousands of Palestinians held as political prisoners by Israel, and so forth.
Well, I think the Israeli government has long attempted to crush any information about their violations, about, you know, for instance, to the international courts, about all sorts of violent international law, and that this is a continuation of their policy of suppressing criticism of the occupation and the siege of Gaza.
Human rights defenders are not terrorists and should never be accused like this. Clearly, Israel intends to silence the violations that it is committing in the occupied territories by attacking the civil society organizations. Therefore, if not responded to swiftly and properly, this could give the green light to Tel Aviv that it can shamelessly continue its crimes against Palestinians.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. It was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of China, of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians, the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could, or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has warned against any of its independence bids. Tensions escalated recently over Chinese military flights as well as increased U.S. military support for Taiwan. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. media reported that American forces had been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all world countries recognize that sovereignty. The U.S., too, recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long curtailed Taipei in an attempt to unnerve Beijing. The United States, which backs Taipei's separatist president, also continues to sell weapons to the island in defiance of Beijing and in violation of its own official policy.
What they call a strategic ambiguity in American policy. They like to keep Taiwan as in some kind of de facto independent status, but they have recognized de jure that it's one country and Taiwan is a part of China.
China has also denounced the recently clinched AUKUS pact between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S., under which the trio is expected to make a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Beijing argues that the pact threatens regional stability and poses nuclear proliferation risks. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing.
Abdulbari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said, sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The U.S. has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity, as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel, mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran, is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador has stirred controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number three diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nolan, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nolan was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the U.S.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 1-9395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. In this episode, you will be listening to the Imam's viewpoints on the duties of the lawmakers and the responsibility of the nation and the body for vetting the qualification of lawmakers, Guardian Council, toward parliamentarian elections. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, with much care, scrutinizes the role of parliament in the country and writes in his testament, among the important affairs is the commitment of the members of the Islamic Council Assembly. We saw what calamitous damages Islam and Iran suffered from the unrighteous and deviated parliament since the post-constitutional era till the era of the criminal Pahlavi regime, and worse and more dangerous than any time during this imposed corrupt regime, and what destructive catastrophes and damages were inflicted on the country and nation by these worthless and servile criminals. During these 50 years, a bogus, deviated minority against an innocent majority caused Britain and the Soviet Union, and recently the U.S., to do whatever they wish through these very deviants and drag the country to decadence and destruction. Since the post-constitutional era, the important clauses of the Constitution had never been put into effect. Before Reza Khan, this was due to the vestoxicated and a handful of Khans and land feudalists. And during the Pahlavi era, by the bloodthirsty regime and its lackeys and vassals. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, now with God's grace and the effort of the grand nation, the country's fate has been put in people's hands, and the lawmakers are from the people and have entered the parliament with their election without the intervention of governments and Khans of regions. And we hope that with their commitment to Islam and the country's interest, any deviation would be prevented. I recommend to the nation for the present time and future.
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We interrupt our regular programming to bring you live coverage of the second Foreign Ministers' Conference of countries neighboring Afghanistan. This international conference is being organized by Iran's foreign ministry. Currently, the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amin Abdullahian, is speaking. Let's listen in.
We have the first vice president, Dr. Mokhber, attending the session today. also there was another priority and there was a need for the necessity for Dr. Raisi, President Raisi, to attend another meeting, and for this reason Dr. Mohber is going to attended this meeting. I wish to warmly welcome him, and I wish to call on Dr. Mohber to address the participants. In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, greetings to you all. First, I wish to convey the greetings of President Raisi and his apologies for not being able to attend this session. Distinguished foreign ministers, esteemed envoys, I wish to welcome you all in Tehran, and I hope that through convergence, the meeting would bear fruits. The accelerating trend of developments in Afghanistan is accompanied with hope and worry. There are hardships caused by foreigners' occupation, and also there are hardships due to the foreigners' occupation. Afghanistan's neighboring countries enjoy historical and cultural bonds with Afghanistan. So there are such commonalities shared by Afghanistan and its neighbors, and speaking of, and that actually intertwines peace and tranquility in this region. Security and tranquility of Afghan's neighbors is intertwined with the security of Afghanistan. On this basis, with the welcome initiative by the Islamic Republic of Pakistan for holding the first round of this conference, we are hosting the second round of talks, and we do welcome the hosting of the third round of talks by People's Republic of China. The people of Afghanistan have been for decades experiencing bloodshed and violence. You can hardly find a family in Afghanistan that has not actually lost one of his beloved members. And also, there are those who have been born in a condition of insecurity, and they have lived in insecurity. I commemorate the martyrs of Afghanistan, particularly the martyr worshippers in Qunduz and Kandahar, and we do pray to God to actually help the recovery of the injured. Who are the ones who should be held accountable for this? 2 decades ago, the U.S. and its NATO allies used the 9/11 attacks as a pretext, and the pretext of combating terrorism. They attacked Afghanistan. The 20-year military occupation of Afghanistan just brought about only insecurity, the spread of extremism, and it led to the spread of terrorism, economic backwardness, and it dismantled the foundations of independence in that country. It led to an increase in drug production and caused the bereavement of thousands of Afghan families. The unwise policies and irresponsible and unilateral measures by the United States in Afghanistan, with more than $2.5 trillion of spending, just brought about a failure. Speaking of nation building, the U.S. faced a failure. The collapse of the Afghan government in less than 2 weeks clearly showed that during the past two decades, the U.S. Has been quite unfamiliar with the Afghan culture. The scandalous escape of the Americans and their allies from Afghanistan in an irresponsible manner brought about painful scenes that can be considered as lessons, and such scenes will forever remain in the memory of the Afghan people. No occupier can bring about security, peace, and tranquility to the occupied area lands, and reliance on foreigners cannot strengthen any government. The U.S. defeat has been an opportunity for the Afghan people and neighboring countries, but we should also bear in mind that the U.S., by fleeing Afghanistan, actually created this burden on the shoulders of the Afghan people, a burden of pain and sufferings. We are unwantedly facing this situation in Afghanistan today. Today, we are facing the ongoing situation in Afghanistan in an unwanted manner, but we have this responsibility that through supporting one another and in the nexus of through consultations and cooperation by other countries and the UN, the impediments must be removed in order to form a strong government in Afghanistan and help that government for maintaining security there and contribute to that country's reconstruction. Distinguished participants, today Afghanistan is facing many humanitarian, security, and economic crises. These are the crises faced by Afghanistan. After the U.S. exit, the exit by the occupiers, maintaining and establishing security is a priority for the Afghan people, but the Takfiri terrorism, including Daesh, that is acting as a U.S. proxy force in the region, is targeting Afghanistan's security, and by targeting the citizens, similar to what you saw in the mosques in Kunduz and Kandahar, they are after creating a new civil conflict by causing provocative measures due to the diverse ethnicities in Afghanistan. This is the duty of the Afghans today, not to allow the reactionaries and aggressors to threaten the security of Afghanistan. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is another tragedy, and that's been due to domineering and wrong policies pursued by the Americans there, and that has caused serious livelihood problems for the Afghan people. Confiscation of the properties of the Afghan people and halting economic projects and halting humanitarian aid by various countries are among the major elements that have caused the current economic crisis there. And measures must be, and the solutions must be found for removing the crisis. Otherwise, the crisis will go beyond the borders and will also influence and overshadow the neighbors and the world community, the global community. The hike in prices of foodstuff and the fuel crisis in Afghanistan has double concerns about the human tragedy there. The Islamic Republic of Iran is concerned about the oppressed people of Afghanistan and invites the neighbors to share views and support one another via the existing mechanisms, such as the ECHO Fund or any other initiative, take up the necessary measures as soon as possible in order to assist the Afghan people, in order to overcome the economic crisis there. In this connection, the Islamic Republic of Iran, based on the basic strategy by the leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has opened the crossing border crossing points for the transfer of assistance to Afghanistan and other transit infrastructures, including ports and land crossing points, and also Chabahar port, are accessible. The human crisis in Afghanistan is the outcome of security and economic crises there. Today, millions of Afghans have been displaced. Regretfully, the trend continues. The economic and security crises have caused serious concerns about the ongoing situation and also has caused concern about the future of Afghanistan. Such a concern has caused the flow of new refugees towards neighboring states. In the past 40 years, the Islamic Republic of Iran has hosted millions of Afghan brothers and sisters. But the imposed economic war and the U.S. tyrannical sanctions, due to such sanctions, it's not possible to handle such an influx of refugees, and for this reason, other countries and international bodies must pay attention to humanitarian responsibilities and also hand over humanitarian aid and allocate aid and also help the collective management of the problem. The growing traffic in narcotic drugs and also the possibility of terrorist groups collaborate.